Everyone, welcome back to the Reformed Fringe, our rebranded podcast from the Kingdoms Podcast. Now Reformed Fringe, it's kind of aligning, John, with our goal to have a Reformed Fringe community that is growing like crazy, gangbusters, having a lot of fun in our discussions over at reformfringe.com. We have a lot of materials there. We have a lot of people that you can interact with. And it's just, it's a fun place to be. And for especially reformed, like-minded people who aren't hostile to Reformed theology, we welcome anybody as long as you're not trying to troll us or whatever.
Because if you want to talk about fringy things and you're not going to get bent out of shape about Reformed theology, come on over.
And
we've got dispensationalists in there. I know that for a fact.
We do. So yeah, I'm your host. I'm Doug Van Dorn, and you can learn more about me at douglasvandorn.com, pastor at the Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado in Boulder, crazy Boulder, which is 20 square miles surrounded by reality, they say. And with me is John Moffitt, pastor of Grace Reformed Church out in Nashville-ish, Tennessee.
Yep.
And you can learn more about John at johnmoffitt.com. So, John, today we want to talk a little bit, kind of continue going a little bit with where we were at last week.
Sure.
Piggybacking off of it, I guess.
Sure.
Where we were talking about myth, and we got a little bit into Psalm 82, which we've talked about on more than one occasion in the former iterations of this podcast. But I kind of want to revisit it just a little bit. We're not going to go through or rehash the whole Psalm. But no, I had a thought that struck me that I, for whatever reason, hadn't really considered it in exactly this way before. As people argue about Psalm 82 being this, people that are just judges, human judges in verse one,
desupernaturalizing.
And we mentioned that in the last episode that this textual variant of judges really only appears in the second century AD. And it comes through the rabbis.
Yeah.
And the earlier version of that was that it wasn't judges, it was Elohim. Very, very different words in Hebrew and in Greek for that matter. And so in thinking about who these gods are, you know, we've made the case that they're heavenly beings, and we're actually going to talk quite a bit more about that today. But I was really struck just a few days ago, just the thought hit me that I actually think that verse 8 needs to be considered much more in this discussion of this psalm and who the people are in verse 1. So it's a short psalm. We can go ahead and read it again just so people can get the feeling for what it says. It says, God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked, Selah? Give justice to the weak and fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. For they have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. That's an interesting word that we'll actually talk about later. Darkness. Uh-huh. That just struck me. I hadn't really thought about that before. How interesting. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I said, you are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men, you shall die and fall like any prince. And then here's the verse that struck me. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all the nations. And what struck me was, you know, we mentioned something about how God in verse 1 last time in the Dead Sea Scrolls is sometimes referred to as Melchizedek. So Melchizedek has taken his place in the divine council. That's super weird. But if that's true, then the God arising in verse 8, who's inheriting the nations, has to be related to these gods who are judging the nations or not ruling the nations properly, right? He's the God of verse 1 in verse 8. God in verse 8, arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all the nations, is the God of verse 1 who takes his place in the council and then judges the gods for not ruling. Well, what does this necessitate? It necessitates that, and this is saying the obvious, I think, and yet it's not obvious when you take this, the desupernaturalized view. The gods of verse one have to be, drumroll, ruling the nations.
That's right.
Because the God of verse eight is now inheriting the nations. So the gods of verse one have to rule the nations, which is why in verses two through four, they are not showing justice to the nations. Now, when you come to the other kind of reading of this, it will say things like God has taken his place in the midst of the rulers, or in the count, you know, in this like synagogue council of Jews and that kind of a thing. Like you have, there's different versions of this out there, but to me, I don't know any of these rulers. Like if, let's say it was the Sanhedrin. What, how are they ruling the nations? That doesn't even make sense.
No.
Right? So who are these rulers? Well, you go back to Psalm 2, and you find that this is connected directly to Psalm 82.
Yep.
Psalm 82 is a psalm of Asaph. Psalm 2 is, there's no ascription given to who wrote it. It's right. one of the, basically Psalm 1 and 2 are a pair that begin right. with the Son and end with the Son. And this is what it says.
You mean Psalm 1 and 2 are about Jesus?
Psalm 1 and 2 are about Jesus. Blessed is the man, right? And then that's at the very end of the psalm, you need to kiss the Son, lest he be angry with you. But the famous part of Psalm 2, beginning, probably because of Handel's Messiah, I suppose, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? So those are earthly. Mm-hmm. The kings of the earth set themselves. So that's also earthly. They're the kings. They're the rulers of the earth. Well, the king is not the word that's used even in the alternate of Psalm 82, verse 1. Something totally different. These are the kings. And then the rulers take counsel together. Who are the rulers of Psalm 2, verse 2? Well, it seems to me that the kings of the earth are distinguished from the rulers. So who would the rulers be? You'd think they would probably be the rulers taking counsel in the heavenly places, because they're working in league together, tandem.
Right.
In fact, you find in the very next part of the verse, you have two again that are counterpart against the Lord Yahweh and against his anointed. So you've got the Father and the Son, as good Christian exegesis would point that. And then the Father and the Son are talking to each other. Let's cast their bond. Well, the people are saying, let's cast their bonds apart and cast their cords away from us. But he who sits in heaven laughs. That's the Father. And the one, the Son, holds them in derision. And then the great promise of the New Testament, that one of the most famous quoted Old Testament passages in all the New Testaments, quoted over and over, about Jesus. As for me, I've set my king on my Zion, my hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. That's language that we mentioned last week in Psalm 110, verse 3 in the Septuagint about Melchizedek.
Being begotten, yeah.
But here's the key to Psalm 82. Ask of me and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. That goes back actually to Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 9, where the Lord inherits Jacob. And who inherits things? Sons inherit things.
That's right.
So the sons of God inherit the nations in verse 8. The Son inherits Israel. Now in Psalm 2, the Son, if he will just ask the Father, he will inherit all the ends of the earth. And then in Psalm 82, you have the Son judging the heavenly beings. And now he will inherit all the nations.
That's right.
So that's right. Just that weird thought that these rulers of Psalm 82, verse 1 have to be rulers of the nations, which fits exactly into the divine council worldview, even as Psalm 82 is directly linked to Deuteronomy chapter 32 and the divine council kind of epicenter of the whole Old Testament.
Mm-hmm. Well, who cares, Doug? Why does that matter? Well, that's what we're going to talk about next.
Yeah, John, you have lots and lots of very interesting information, kind of new thoughts that you've been working on with regard to
I do, yes.
the council and the princes and this kind of stuff. So go for it.
Sure. So we'll put it in here. By the time this comes out, I'll probably be done. I took a break. I just finished First and Second Peter. I always take a break and do a series on something. I'm doing a series on the principalities and powers, reading some fantastic work by a couple of Anglican brothers that I've been really, really thankful for their work. These books were written 25 years before Michael Heiser wrote his book. So fantastic.
I thought Michael Heiser made everything up.
Oh, that's right. We're Heiserites. So sorry, Michael Heiser, he wrote everything. I only talk about what he wrote. So God rest his soul, bless that man, and all those weird people who speak angrily against him. Doug, we can only talk about people we completely agree with. So, I am fascinated by how many times, so we're getting ready to go into the resurrection season.
Yeah.
Easter's coming up, and I love that there is the ransom theory that's been out throughout our history, and if you pay attention, what Jesus is doing and how Paul talks about, he raises from the grave and puts the rulers and principality to open shame. I love that verse. And by the way, what are the principalities doing right now? What is Satan doing right now as the great accuser, Doug? He's putting us to shame because we have failed to obey the law. He's constantly saying they are in shame. They are guilty. They should not be cared by you and love. You should put wrath on them. And Jesus comes up, breaks this right in front of them and says, you're now in shame. No longer are my children, no longer are my people in shame. It's beautiful. So there's parts of the resurrection that get lost because we don't understand, what does Paul mean? He puts them to open shame. Like, why is his resurrection such a big deal to the spiritual realm? It's a massive deal to the spiritual realm. And I think that the gospel is often truncated. We only think about the physical and personal relationships to the gospel, Doug, and we never think about the global and spiritual ramifications. Peter literally says in 2 Peter, he's trying to encourage them to stay faithful and be looking toward the resurrection. And he's like, and when he comes back, he's going to burn up all the heavenly bodies. Why is that such a big deal? Because that church felt what the heavenly bodies were doing to them and the church, and they're causing so much havoc. And he's like, don't worry, God's bringing judgment. God's bringing judgment. So Paul uses these victory language, these victory passages, as a way to encourage the church and say, oh, he's winning. He has won. And just wait to see what he's done. I'm a poet and didn't know it. Okay. So that being said, principalities and powers become a very important part of our faith. Paul mentions it many times. We'll do a whole episode on the principalities and powers later. This is kind of an introductory passage. But Paul mentions it multiple times in Ephesians, multiple times in Colossians. And so this is a part of his language. So to understand where Paul is getting it and how it works and how it functions, that's what I want to introduce a little bit. So Doug just proved to us in Psalm 82, verse 8, that these rulers, they have to be spiritual beings. They have to be what we would then argue from Deuteronomy 32, the sons of God. They become known as princes.
Well, Psalm 82 calls them the sons of God. Psalm 82:6 says you're sons.
Hey, I had a different thought. This is like off script. We're going to leave the recording going. Do you think when Jesus was using John 10 as an example, do you think he had in mind even verse 8 where he talks about, I'm the one, I'm the God who's inheriting the nations. I'm the one he's talking about, that I'm here to inherit the nations.
Yeah. I always think that when you find a quote in the New Testament, it's my opinion, that you never find these quotes being taken just completely helicopter exegesis. You fly in, you land, you pick the verse up, and then you just fly with it wherever you want. Like, it always has the whole context in mind.
Context.
And when you understand that, it actually brings a great richness to the New Testament. Where it's quoting that, you go back and read the whole context, and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, there's so much more here than I thought that there was just from the one little verse quote or whatever.
Yeah, basically he's saying, I'm the one who inherits the nations.
Who's inheriting the nations, right?
I'm the Messiah. So total side note, actually not a side note. That is just a little hit to the end of the podcast. Okay, so just to help you understand, principalities, that means you have a prince over it. It means you have a large group of body of people and land. and they become the prince over that principality. And multiple times we learn in scripture, as it is in earth, as it is on earth, it is in heaven. And God uses councils and structures and armies, and he uses rulers and principalities. So Paul is talking about this, and where is he getting it? We're going to argue he's getting it, and even Stephen, he's getting it from the Old Testament. So what you start learning, and we've given examples in Daniel, where Daniel talks about the prince of Greece and the prince of Persia, and there's a fight that's happening there.
They have to be heavenly supernatural beings, right? Because, well, first of all, one of them's Michael, and he's
right.
Everybody knows he's an angel. And then you have him fighting with another angel, Gabriel.
That's
so
right.
Why would a human, what sense does it even make that a human prince is fighting with an angelic messenger? Like, so those princes in Daniel 10 have to be supernatural entities. That's, I think, your point, but it needs to be stated again.
It does. So today we're going to argue and show that I think there's some allusions to this, very strong allusions to the idea of there being ruling principalities. I think Daniel's one of the greatest arguments, so we'll start there. I mean, it's flat out calls them a prince, and every prince has a principality, has beings underneath his rule. And
since you're talking about prince, the word for prince is an archon, and that's
right.
The very same word for a ruler in Psalm 2, where it says the kings of the earth and the rulers, the archons.
Cons.
Now, sometimes those archons can be human. I'll admit that.
Sure.
But
sure.
That is also the word that's used for the heavenly princes. So here you have, again, kind of like with man, where heavenly beings are called men, but they're never called Adam men. They're called Ish. Same thing. We're both called rulers because we share some kind of something in common with
each other. Paul calls Satan the archon of this
the
world.
The archon. That's right.
Yeah. All right. So there's a fascinating story. Put an article about this. We can link it to it. There's a fascinating story about, there's more than one story about this god Shamash. And should pull up my argument here. Here we go. Okay. So Shamash becomes, he's used quite often in the Old Testament and pretty well known. And what you learn is that Shamash is over a particular land. Now, I pointed this out to somebody recently, Doug. Most people don't pay attention. When a god is named, they give a name. It's very rare they don't give a location. It's very rare, right? Mm. It's like it's the god of this location, right? And when it says, when you go into that nation, do not take up their god, which I think is fascinating, that there's a location to these gods, these beings that are there. And I think some of this is, I'm going to argue here, is in reference to Deuteronomy 32 and Psalm 82, where God dispersed these beings, these sons of God, to be the rulers of the nations. And instead, what does Psalm 82 say they did? They turned the nations against God, and they worshiped themselves. So In Judges, I'm going to actually just go and not just read a portion of it. So if you go to Judges 11,
people are turning there, I just did a type in my ESV. It's very interesting. You're going to bring this up, but the first few times that Chemosh is mentioned, Numbers 21, woe to you, O Moab, you are undone, O people of Chemosh.
That's right.
Judges
people
11.
Of Chemosh.
Will you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? First Kings, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab. Again, you're right. They keep saying of Moab every time Chemosh is mentioned.
That's right.
Why would you do that? I hadn't really noticed that before.
Yeah, the goddesses, they'll talk about the goddesses of this particular land. I mean, we're going to look at a couple of passages because Stephen does the same thing. He associates it with a particular place. Okay, so you got Jephthah here. He's talking about, we're not going to get into the entire context. You can go back and read it in Judges 11. But this is the argument that he makes, and listen to it. It says, so then the Lord, the God of Israel, dispossessed the Amorites from before his people Israel. And are you to take possession of them? Will you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? And all that the Lord our God has dispossessed before us, we will possess.
Wait
a
minute.
There is a...
That Chemosh gives you is what it says?
It's what it says.
So it Chemosh, says, this idol that doesn't exist, is giving things to people? Is Jephthah really that stupid?
Yeah, that's the point. The point is, Jephthah never clarifies and never, like, desupernaturalizes nothing. And this isn't an obscure passage. I'm going to prove it to you here in a minute, okay? But you have here Jephthah saying, okay, listen, this is what has been given to the people of Israel. This is what God has dispossessed. And so he's making this argument of land and where people belong, right? And he flat out says, will you not possess what Chemosh, your God, and we've learned that he is the God of Moab.
Moab.
This is what the land is an issue of, right? So your God has given you to possess.
So it's a turf war. And in that same verse, the Lord, our God, that's interesting because it's possessive.
That's
so
right.
He's our God, just like Chemosh is your God, and he has dispossessed them so that we will now possess it. Is that, I mean, that's what's going on. So you have, what sense does it make to have an entity that doesn't exist giving things compared directly to an entity that does exist giving things?
That's right. I pointed this out to you earlier. It's not in my article, but this is 2 Kings 1. And it's interesting. So Ahaziah falls from his lattice and thinks he's going to die. And so he says, hey, go.
Right.
It says, go inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron. There it is again. So they're always associating it with something, the god of Ekron. And then it says, but the Lord said to Elisha the Tishbite, arise up to meet the messenger of the king of Samaria and say to them, is it because there is no God in Israel that you are going to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? Like, there's these territorial gods that he's talking about, which is fascinating to me. I'm just pointing it out as an example that it's not foreign to the Israelite mind that there are gods that are stationed in different parts of the land. Okay. That being said, later on, this king is in a war. And so this is the king of Moab. The king is in a war. This is 2 Kings chapter 3. He's losing the war. We've done a passage on that. We've done this on, we're talking about the idols and the gods. Do they have power? But I want to mention it again, that when the king of Moab makes a sacrifice of his son because he's about to lose to Israel, who's the sacrifice going to? Well, it's going to Chemosh because he's the god of Ekron. Sorry, he's the god of Moab.
Moab.
And it says great wrath fell upon Israel and Israel left Moab. They went out of the land, right? So you have two instances now in Judges and in Kings where they're talking about there being a territorial being and it has authority and apparently it has power of some sort because it brings wrath upon Israel. We're not going to get into that, you know, the whole thing of like, well, did God lose a war? It's a whole debate there. Second causes. We're not going to get into that. You can go listen to our podcast on first cause and second causes, right? Then when you go down, it says that this would be later on. This is in second. This is going to be with Solomon. It says that, and so this is 1 Kings 11:7. This is where we're going to make a connection to the New Testament here in a minute. There we go. 1 Kings 11 and verse 7. It says that, so we learned this from the Old Testament, that Solomon, unfortunately, the wisest man in the world, had his heart turned by his wives to worship other gods. And Doug, I had this thought, I was driving all the way over here today when we recorded. I'm thinking, Solomon interacted with the God of gods. I mean, he interacted with Yahweh. I mean, the guy, and then he worshiped other gods. You have to imagine in his mind that there, you know what I mean? Like, these other gods have to have some kind of pull and power on upon him, because they, even the children of Israel kept pulling their hearts away from. I have a hard time when people go ahead.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I think it's so important to understand that the angel of the Lord is the God of Israel. The angel is. And so people will go, how could you be so dumb as to worship a created being when you have the uncreated creator right in front of you that you're worshiping, that you know? So I've long suspected that when the second person comes to people in the Old Testament, it's through the very same I guess, created nature, for lack of a better way of putting it, as what the other sons of God were. They were angels. Right. He's an angel. And it's very much alike what we find in the New Testament, that Jesus came as a human being. He didn't come as a supernatural Zeus figure that's dropping lightning bolts that, of course, if you saw, they'd be like, yes, you're definitely not one of us. He came exactly like one of us, which is why they put him to death, because they didn't believe he was who he said he was. Because my point is that it's like and like. Jesus is a man just like other men. Jesus in the Old Testament is an angel, an angelic being, just like the other angelic beings. And that, to me, can help have a little bit of explanatory power why Moses or why Solomon would be so quick to turn to these other entities. Maybe he didn't believe that the angel of the Lord actually was the creator of these other entities. Maybe he had problems digesting that truth for whatever reasons. But I think that that's a way to, at least for me, to satisfy that kind of curiosity. How could he do that?
That's right. So then it says in 1 Kings 11:7, then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, again, location, and for Molech, the abomination of the Amorites, on the mountain of east of Jerusalem.
So correct, creating a high place. Ammonites. Ammonites, Moab and Ammon are the siblings of Lot. I only bring that up because the Amorites are the giants, and this is...
Oh, did I say Amorites? Ammonites.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's creating places of worship for these gods. Now, Doug, you pointed this out. I'll turn this over to you. There's a fascinating little tidbit then about... so I'm going to point this out. If there's principalities and powers, according to Paul, we have princes of Greece and Persia that are being described there. Now we have territorial beings like Chemosh and Molech that are being described as princes. They are told that they can give possessions of land. They have power. All of a sudden, we go to the New Testament and we have Stephen talking about another example of acknowledging a powerful being such as Molech.
Yeah, this is in Stephen's speech to the Jews. And so it's in Acts chapter 7. And the context is he's recounting the history of Israel to the Israelites who are about ready to kill him, with Saul at, you know, they're presiding over the whole thing, apparently. And this is interesting. Actually, looking back at a couple of verses before it, it's important, I think. Verse 41, Acts 7:41, they made a calf in those days and offered a sacrifice to the idol and were rejoicing in the works of their hands. But God turned away and gave them over to worship the host of heaven. As it is written in the book of the prophets, so he quotes Amos now, did you bring me slain beasts and sacrifices during the 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? You took up the tent of Moloch and the star of your god, Raphon, the images that you made to worship, and I will send you into exile beyond Babylon. Now, again, you find throughout the prophets this kind of, almost, I think, a sarcastic mocking of the gods as just, they're just idols. They're just things made with hands. At the very same time that you also find them identifying them as real entities.
The host,
because they're mocking. People only need to learn how to read sarcasm and satire and that kind of tone, which the prophets used all the time. But here he's talking about the very entity you just read in 1 Kings, Moloch, the god of the Ammonites.
That's right. Now, what's crazy about Moloch, for whatever reason, so like we learned that these different gods have these different preferences. I was going to use a different word, but have these different weird requirements. And for whatever reason, Moloch is identified as, if you want his power and whatever he brings, you got to sacrifice your children to him.
Yeah.
And right away, the children of Israel told in Deuteronomy, do not do this. I mean, Leviticus. If actually it says, if you do this, you will be taken out of the city, out of the nation. You will be stoned for this. And Doug, for you to take your child and, I mean, if there's children, I'll just say it this way. For you to take the life of your child, let's say it this way, and offer it to the god requires so much faith, it's unreal.
Yeah.
It's unreal, the amount of faith it requires you to do that. You have to be convinced that there's power that is behind that. And this is what Stephen is saying. If he turned them to worship the host of heaven. And then Stephen names as an example of the ones that they are turning their hearts to, which is Moloch, are the whole point in this. And he is known as the one who is over the Ammonites. So My argument is this: you have Old Testament prophets and writers and New Testament writers, Stephen is an example, and then Paul just sums them all up. Instead of just naming them, he just sums, well, he'll name Satan for sure, but he sums them all up and just says principalities and powers. Now, here's the connection, guys. This is super cool. I'm super nerded out about this. We've made this connection before, but we're going to make it again. Okay, go back to Psalm 82. What did the sons of God fail to do? They failed to protect the people and keep their hearts towards God. They failed to do that. And it says they, not only that, they didn't punish the wicked. They let the wicked thrive, because what were the wicked people doing? They were worshiping the God. They were worshiping them as gods. They loved it, right? So what does he say at the end? At the end, my son is going to inherit the nations. So Jesus shows up and he says, all authority in heaven and in earth, which means all the principalities and powers in the spiritual realm and everything that's on the earth, is now mine. And I'm sending you guys to storm the gates of hell. And you're going to go in and you're going to take people out of the domain of darkness under these principalities. And you're going to bring them into my kingdom. You're going to go into their domain and you're going to take them out of their domain. And what does it say? You pointed this up in Ephesians 2. We are born in whose domain? We're born in Satan's domain. And so when it says in Ephesians 6 that you're going to be wrestling against it, what's the church doing? The church is taking the gospel to the nations. And what are the nations doing? These are my people. This is my land. I'm their God. And what does Jesus say? They don't have the authority to stop you anymore. They have zero authority. You go and do your job, but they are going to fight you. They're going to oppose you because they still think they're the authority of it, but they have been put to open shame because I beat them. They tried to kill me. They did kill me. What they didn't realize is that I used that, or God the Father used that, to rescue my people.
Yeah, this is a deep thread we're pulling on here. You brought up Colossians to me before we started filming this, and he has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved son. It's very similar to the language you find in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1, where you're, walking in the darkness of the prince of the air and that kind of
walking
stuff.
Walking in the path. That's right.
Dead in your trespasses and sins. But here you have a domain, a kingdom. So you're being transferred from one kingdom to another. But this means you were actually born into this dark kingdom. And it just kind of struck me as you were talking that here you have Jesus telling us, now all authority in heaven and earth has been given me because he has risen from the dead. Well, so who cares about the heavenly part?
That's
right. If there are no heavenly beings that are ruling in a domain of darkness, that are holding people in slavery, that had them legally theirs because of this transaction that happens at the Tower of Babel that Moses tells us about in Deuteronomy 32, where he sets the sons of God over the nations and gives the nations to the sons of God. If that isn't real, then what does it matter what authority Jesus has in heaven? And what is this language of being transferred out of a domain of the kingdom of Satan into another kingdom of his son? That none of that language makes any sense at all.
That's right.
And yet we find it all the time as in the New Testament.
Yeah, when it says that when he rose from the grave, he put them to open shame. Why? Why did he put him to open shame? Because I love this, because Paul says they didn't know, these rulers, these principalities and powers, they had no clue what the Father's plan was. It's called the mystery of Christ, right? And Paul says it was hidden from them. And if they would have known, these rulers, if they would have known, they would have never crucified the Lord of glory. But they did crucify him. And when he rose from the grave, they realized, oh, we weren't supposed to do that. The very thing we thought brought us victory actually brought us defeat. And so it says, I love this, right? Peter says he goes down into the underworld and he proclaims victory over the spirits that are down there because they tried to create havoc through the giants. That's a whole nother podcast you can go to. And then he comes up and he puts all the principality and power to open shame. And then he goes to the humans and says, by the way, I love how Paul says, God chose the weak things of the world to confound the wise, right? Those beings that all the nations are worshiping, all of these principalities that everybody's in awe with and they sacrifice their children to, he goes, you little humans are going to have more power than they do because you're proclaiming the power of God. I mean, this stuff is so awesome. Like in Romans 8, when he says, nothing will separate you from the love of God, right? And he names angels. Why would he do that? Because if you understand Paul's theology, he thinks that these demonic beings, these nefarious, powerful beings, that it's like, well, Paul, what about these? He's like, nope, Jesus put them to open shame. He conquered them. They're not in judgment yet, but they will be soon.
You know, I don't remember if we talked about this in an episode or not with the Transfiguration and Psalm 89. Have we talked about that?
You've referenced it, but no, we should probably do a whole episode.
So yeah, we could do a whole show on it. It's very, very interesting. The overlaps between Psalm 89 and Jesus at Caesarea Philippi with the gates of hell and then up on the Mount of Transfiguration. Like there are almost 20 different linguistic parallels between these stories and that psalm. That makes me think what happened at the Transfiguration was a legal declaration that Jesus is going to, it's kind of like, bring it, that's the point where the declaration of who this God of Psalm 82 is, that's where it was made first, on the very mountain of Baal himself, in front of him, who then falls like lightning because he's the lightning God from heaven when he sees it. And he falls like lightning in a rage, trying to figure out how he can stop the beloved son, Jesus, from getting this inheritance. And it's all legal language. This reminds me of our Reformed roots, right? So we love covenant theology. And Psalm 89 is this declaration of a covenant from beginning to end of a new covenant that's going to be met. And then that covenant that's then declared on top of the mountain is then cut in the blood of Jesus on another mountain in Israel on the cross. And what I'm bringing this up for is that people need to understand that covenants are metaphysical things.
Right.
They're not just physical. The blood is enacting some kind of legal transfer. Now, you got to think about this. Put your thinking caps on for just a minute. Because if Jesus is disinheriting and those gods were given to the nations, I believe that there was a covenant that was made between those nations and those gods. They had broken the covenant, which is what Psalm 82 is all about. And Jesus, through the enacting of the new covenant, now legally has the right over anybody that he wants in these other domains that he's bringing them out of, and they can't stop it on a legal covenantal basis. Now, what sense does any of that make if there is no actual entities that are ruling and have legal rights over the people? Makes sense. So this goes even to the heart and soul of the new covenant and what the new covenant means that we reform people love to talk about. And all we're doing here is just adding layers of richness and meaning. We're not taking away anything in terms of what we believe the new covenant is and what covenant theology does and how important it is in the scripture. We're just adding to it. And I think actually that this is also related to why the prophets, Jeremiah and Isaiah, for example, will talk about how God is divorcing Israel. That's covenant language, because they've committed adultery, idolatry with the gods of the nations. What sense does that make if these entities aren't real And there's not something going on when Solomon is setting up these temples and reinstating the groves and all this other kind of stuff.
Okay. Dude, check this out. So as you're saying this, I remember preaching this. Man, my cold is crushing me. 1 Peter 1:18, knowing that you were ransomed, okay? What does the word ransom means? It means you were owned by something else.
Yeah.
Something else had control over you. This is what I love about the Chronicles of Narnia and the White Witch. By the way, I never knew this, but someone put this in the Reformed Fringe the other day, that the White Witch was the child of a Nephilim and, the owl, what's her name? Lilith. The offspring of Lilith and Nephilim. Did you know this?
I did not know that.
That's in the Chronicles of Narnia. That's why she's so tall.
Wow.
So it's fascinating. Yeah. I just thought that was interesting. Okay. So it says, but the reason I was mentioning that is that the White Witch, she looks at Aslan and says, this young man belongs to me because of what he's done. Right. So we're under this domain. And because of our crimes, we are against the king. We deserve the wrath. It says, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways, to your point, inherited from your forefathers. Well, what were the forefathers doing? They're worshiping the other gods, right? Not with perishable things such as silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. That's your point. Our ransom out of the worship of the nations or the worship of these other gods was brought about by the blood of Jesus Christ. I mean, the whole thing is connected. It's beautiful. As you were saying that, I was like, oh, that's total 1 Peter 1:18.
Yeah. Yeah, when they're redeemed out of slavery from Egypt, guess who owned them? Egypt. There was something actually there that was that's over right. them that they were redeemed and ransomed from.
That's right.
So it's got to be the same in the spiritual realm. It has to be.
I mean, there's so many connections. When you're talking about redeemed, this is so funny. I haven't thought about this. Redeemed out of Egypt. What did he do to the gods? He totally shamed them. He embarrassed the gods. Remember this? Every plague had a relation to one of the gods. Mm-hmm. And what does it say in what he says in Colossians, when he rose from the grave, he put the gods to open shame, the connection that is there. Anyways, there's so many fun connections. We're already at 42 minutes, so we should probably think about connecting this down. Okay, I want to go back to last week's, Doug, because I know you got super excited about it last week. This is why this podcast matters to Doug and I, because when we get up on Sunday mornings and we preach and we minister week in and week out through teaching the Bible and shepherding and caring for people, we want people to believe in the gospel of Jesus Christ and the supernatural power of him ransoming them out of this domain, because the domain still exists and the beings are still doing their work and they're still confusing the nations. And if we get confused by these beings, then we're not going to be proclaiming the gospel. We're not going to be living in light of the gospel, in the freedom of the gospel. And we're going to be, what does Paul say? Don't submit yourself once again. What? To the beings that had control over us, to the sides of our flesh. So we think that it's important for us to have a proper understanding of Psalm 82, Deuteronomy 32, and all of these passages that are related to the principalities and powers of the nations, because it directly connects to the work of the church. It's not for funsies.
Right.
It's not a side path. I think it works. It has a direct connection to the work of the church, and that's why we want to talk about it.
You know, I don't know if I've shared this with you or not, but when I was preaching through Leviticus, I learned about something called a weave, which is a way of writing literature to pattern it, to make it look like the literature itself looks something that you're writing about. And I'm starting to be more and more convinced that Luke and Acts were actually written to be patterned after the Divine Council Mountain, and that there may very well be 70 units in this. And at the top of it, so everybody has long known that at Luke and Acts are a giant chiasm. So Luke begins in Rome, and then it goes to Galilee, and then it goes to Judea and Samaria, and then it goes to Jerusalem, and it ends at the ascension.
Sure.
Acts reverses it. It starts at the ascension, Then it goes to Jerusalem, and then it goes to Judea, Samaria. Then it goes out to the Gentile world, and it ends in Rome. The ascension acts almost like the glory cloud over Mount Sinai, if you want to give it a picture for right. how Luke is arranging the material. Now, what's so wild about that to me is that Jesus, so if you think about why are we called sons of God as Christians, where does that title come from? Well, it comes from the heavenly counterpart of the angelic sons of God that were given to rule over us because of our disobedience at Babel. We become sons of God in the fullest sense of what Adam was supposed to be when he was set on the council in the Garden of Eden and given a seat and told to have dominion. And he abdicated his authority by giving into the temptation of the woman and the serpent. And in doing that, it's like the heavenly beings were then given this rule and authority over us. But Jesus comes along and reverses it. And what's so cool is that in Luke, the number 70 is used with he sends out his 70 disciples. Remember that? And mm-hmm. they come back and they say, we have all authority over serpents and scorpions and demons. And Jesus in the middle of that says, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Like all of this is supernatural language and the authority right. that the 70 now have. And what's going on, I think, I gave you a picture earlier of a hourglass. So mm-hmm. at the top, it's like God has these heavenly beings, but they've been disinherited and all the sand is now falling through and it has to fall right through the center of Jesus, who fulfills and does all this covenantal stuff that we're talking about and then transfers us as Christians to become the lower end of that now hourglass, where now the 70 is represented in the church. That's and right. Luke and Acts are woven together so that as happens to Jesus throughout his life, so happens to the church in its life. And John's gospel and Revelation are exactly the same. Yep. As it goes with Jesus, so goes with the church, because God in his infinite wisdom has chosen to let us be the vessels through which the kingdom of Jesus is going to come to people through this earth. And especially that happens through the mission of his church. Well, that's Amen. The 70 makes so much sense of who the church actually is and becomes, because Paul's outreaching the nations, right? And I think Kaiser actually brings this point up, and I think it's a great way maybe to end the show.
Sure.
I think it's such a massively important point that as Paul's going, he keeps saying, I need to get to Rome. I need to get to Rome. And when you go and read the letter of Romans, you find that he's like, I want to get to Spain. I want to get to Spain. Why? Because Spain is the last outpost of the nations in the way that the 70 were viewed. If he gets to Spain, he finishes the mission, and all the 70 nations have been reached. Luke stops the story before Paul gets to Rome. And I think he does this deliberately so that we know as the church that the mission continues until Jesus returns.
That's right.
This reclamation and this carrying out as 70 sons of God, symbolically as his people on the earth, that have now taken over this duty that these heavenly beings had because they were wicked, is given to us, all because Jesus is the Son of God. I mean, just the glories of that are just, you can think about them for the rest of your life.
For sure. You know, I never thought about when Jesus sends out the 70. Never, like the number 70 and the 70 nations.
Yeah, it's deliberate. I mean, this worldview answers why he did that.
I mean, it makes total sense. You're just like, oh, wait a minute.
And like I said, right in the middle of that, when they come back, they're like, we tread on serpents and scorpions. That's language used throughout the ancient Near East of demonic entities. We've casting out demons. And Jesus is like, I know. I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. When? Just a few words ago, a few verses ago, on top of the mountain of transfiguration. That's when.
Well, I think what's even more interesting is that there, I'll say this last thing when we close it down. I think what's more interesting is that Jesus is like, yeah, I know you're fascinated by that, but you're going to do greater works than that.
Yeah.
Like you're going to do something better than casting. You're going to bring people to faith. I mean, not you, but you're going to take life to the people and bring them. I mean, that's what's so fast. Like the very thing, dude, I'm making so many connections as we're talking. The very thing that he says, your job was to protect and lead them to me. He goes, I'm going to have the weak humans go do it because you failed. And they're going to do it with my power and you won't be able to stop them. It's
right. So you think about Jesus, right? He has 12 and then he has a merry band of a few more people, right? That follow him around everywhere. But when you come to Pentecost and you see this massive explosion on that day, 3,000 people or 5,000, whatever it was. And then the next sermon, Peter preaches another thousands of thousands more. And then Paul goes off and you hear by the time he gets back from that third missionary journey that we talked about the last episode, just for a minute.
Sure.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of Jews alone, let alone Gentiles, have become Christians from all over the Roman Empire in 30 years. That's what Jesus is talking about. That's what you're talking about.
Right. That's the thing that's greater than casting out demons. So that's so good. Well, hope you understand why we call it the Reform Fringe, because we're trying to put the fringe back in the Reform. That's our tagline. I think we're just going to add it in. That's our tagline. And that's the point. The fringy parts that we don't want to talk about, they're the parts that matter the most. And we're not ashamed to talk about them because it is the power of God unto salvation. And hopefully we prove that to you today, that all of these passages that we think are important, they are very much related to the work of the church. So thanks for listening. And Lord willing, we'll talk to you guys next week.
Yeah. If you guys like what's going on in this show, make sure that you give us a like on whatever platform you find it on. And that really helps us. The algorithms are really important. So pretend that the like button is Goliath and you're going to go smash his head off just like David.
And it's free. That's awesome. Smash his head off. good night. Come check us out at
Reform Fringe.
Not the, but ReformFringe.com.
ReformFringe.com. See you, everyone.
That's awesome.